This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Find out what Illinois State University graduate students hope to gain by getting union representation.
I've been on food stamps for about 3 out of the 4 semesters that I was a student.
Eric Zdansky is a sociology student working on his master's thesis. He says grad student working conditions affect the learning conditions for undergraduate students. GLT's John Norton talks with the man behind the new night spot called Night Shop. It's offering a full menu and cutting-edge underground music in downtown Bloomington. And Mayor Chris Koos is in the studio. He'll answer questions about Town of Normal water main improvements and the transition from one city manager to the next. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Monday, March 20th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Normal Council is moving forward with the replacement and improvement of some water mains and exchanged farewell praises during the last regular meeting for City Manager Mark Peterson. GLT's Charlie Schlenker has more with the Town of Normal Mayor.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal stopped by Sound Ideas following their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Koos, thanks for your time.
Good to be here.
We'll also talk about the recently approved budget and the Economic Development Council's One Voice trip, but let's start with City Manager Mark Peterson. Last night was his last meeting. You two have mostly presented a united front on issues over the years. Was the appearance the reality?
I would say for the most part. There were times that Mark and the council disagreed on things. I think the Marriott Hotel was one issue. Working with John Q. Hammonds, the council felt that Hammonds was the right person. Staff didn't necessarily agree. But at the end of the day, it worked out. And to Mark's credit, the few times that we didn't agree as a council and a manager, he took that issue or that project like it was his own. He knew that that's what he needed to do, is to do what the council wished to do in terms of policy.
So how did you deal with those disagreements? I mean, how did he – it's a difficult thing to internalize it and champion it if you didn't buy into it at the start.
It wasn't for him. Honestly, it really was not. His ability to deliver what the council wanted, it was core to his management philosophy. He understood quite well and understands quite well the council manager form of government. He knows his role. He knows the council's role. And we're both very good about respecting those boundaries.
How do you craft that relationship?
You know, it takes time. And we talked a little bit about that last night, but the culture of the organization goes back 40, 50 years. And the fact we've got such a good council and the past councils have been such good councils where people understand their role as an elected official. They're not there to do the day-to-day, get in the weeds of running the city. Their job is policy, and they understand that. And they understand and respect the manager's ability to deliver on their policy wishes.
What is your view of Mark Peterson's impact on the town?
It's an enormous impact. Again, it's such a symbiotic relationship between the manager and the council. Mark, you know, in a council-manager form of government, the city council has one employee, the city manager. And the city manager is the CEO of the organization. So where Mark shined is developing a culture of high customer service, expertise in your field, professionalism from the staff. He developed that in the staff. It was there from Dave Anderson, but he took it to the next level. It's a highly tuned organization. It sounds like I'm bragging. I am.
Life after Peterson now, please lay out your view of the transition to the new city manager, Pam Reese.
Well, I think it will be a good transition. I'm sure there are going to be some bumps along the way, but Pam has been there for 27 years. We went through a national search to replace Mark, and Pam rose to the top of that search, so we're pretty confident about that.
Some of the bumps are often stylistic ones more than substantive ones. Exactly. What do you anticipate in terms of a difference in her style versus Mark's?
Ask me that question in a month.
Okay. The town is spending some money, $897,000, on some new water mains. Mm-hmm. Is this routine maintenance or something more?
I wouldn't call it routine maintenance. It's part of an overall master plan that we have for our sewer and water systems. We have found that we have highly corrosive soils, and this is an issue that's kind of popping up nationwide, where people didn't realize the corrosiveness of the soils and the type of materials they were using to put in water mains. So I would call this a major capital improvement. You know, you could call it maintenance, but it's really more of a capital improvement.
What is the condition of the mains?
The ones we're replacing need replacing. They're past their useful life. You can go in and patch them, but it's a revolving door kind of maintenance system. You patch it here, and then a week later you patch it there, and then a month later you patch it there. In the long term, it's much better to replace.
This is Sound Ideas. Mayor Chris Koos is with the Town of Normal and joins us after council meetings. You and other community leaders recently returned from Washington, D.C. They're on the Economic Development Council's One Voice trip. You and other town officials were educating elected officials and others in D.C. on the need for an underpass in Uptown Normal. What did you hear back?
We heard very positive things. We did not get a Tiger Grant, as you well know. But we found out later that we were a high priority project in the Department of Transportation. We didn't really fully expect to get funding on this. We were hopeful, but we know it's a long process. The people that we talked to, the professionals in Federal Railway Administration and Department of Transportation, think it's a good project. They like the fact that it has IDOT support, it has Amtrak support, it has Union Pacific support to get this project done.
A couple of weeks ago, you said that the public library decision not to go forward at this time with a new library south of the tracks that would ease the connection between Uptown and Uptown South, that the underpass would ease that connection, would probably not impact the Tiger Grant request. Are you still of that same mind?
I am, because the library was only a piece of what we call Uptown 2.0. We see businesses locating there. We see non-student residential multifamily locating in that area. So we still think that the underpass is viable and needed.
If the town can't afford to support funding for a new library in the short or even medium term of at least 5 years, as you told GLT a couple weeks ago, how much can the town support funding for an expansion of the existing library?
You know, they're doing a study on that right now, and I think we'll have to wait to see the results of that study to see what's really needed to expand on that site or what they're going to do. I can't answer that at this point.
They've already spent several hundred thousand dollars on a conceptual design for a new library. Is that money wasted?
I don't think so, because they're looking at both options. They're not saying, well, we don't have the money to build a new library, so we're going to abandon that. So I would say these ideas are moving in parallel.
It seems redundant, though.
Yes and no. I mean, the cost of the study of staying in the same place is not that much money. And the best outcome would be to have a new library in a new location. I think that's their preferred outcome. I think a lot of the studies say that that's a better outcome. It's up to us to figure out how to pay for it.
Well, why give up now then?
I would not. They're not giving up on this. They're just looking at all options. And that's please don't look at this as, you know, we decided we can't do A, so we're going to do B. That's not what's going on at all.
That was kind of the rhetoric given by Brian Chase, though, that, mm-hmm. that it was not going to be achievable in even the medium term. So we may as well look at this on the shorter medium term mm-hmm. at the existing facility to meet our needs. And doesn't that put it off for 20 or 30 years?
I don't know, Charlie. I don't think so. I don't like to see it that way. I would still like to see us be able to do it, but we have to be realistic in what we can afford and when we can afford it.
Let's move on to discussion of the recently passed budget. It sets up – how does it set up the town for the next several years of flat to falling revenue?
Actually, if you look at our budget and the cuts that we approved, we were actually – without doing any of those – cuts were fine for this year and next year. It was year 3, 4, and 5 that we started to see trouble. So the actions that we took this year really affect outgoing years, and we feel pretty confident about the cuts we've made to keep a balanced budget. Now we have to see what happens to the local economy. You know, are we going to have to do this exercise again to keep a balanced budget? Will things get better? I don't have that crystal ball.
State Farm recently announced several 500 job cuts here based on IT jobs mm-hmm. and an increase of several hundred jobs of claims jobs.
Right.
Now, the pay differential is probably fairly pronounced, although
I would agree with that.
And State Farm's not unpocketing with what they call proprietary information on that. Mm-hmm. So how much is that going to affect you?
It's definitely going to have an effect. And I think what State Farm is going through is difficult for them, and it's difficult for the community. And I think probably the deeper damage in the short term right now is consumer confidence, and I'm a State Farm employee. Is my job secure or not?
How can that be addressed?
I don't think you
or the council?
I don't think it can be addressed. I think, you know, that's something you have to react to. I don't think we can be proactive about that exercise. State Farm's doing what it needs to do to maintain its integrity as a business.
Are there offsetting factors for the economy that you believe will improve the revenue side of things for the town?
I think they're there, but they're a longer haul. The Rivian project, the Brandt project, we need more of those kinds of initiatives in our community to offset what's happening. We need to diversify our economy. We're finance and insurance right now. We need to diversify that.
And how to do that when the Dallas and Phoenix and Atlanta areas are growing by tens and hundreds of people per day and we're not?
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, if we have jobs that people want in a community that people want to live in, they will stay here.
Mayor Chris Coos, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Absolutely.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us on Sound Ideas following regular and special council meetings. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Off and Running, striving to be Central Illinois' go-to place for all types of runners and walkers by providing top-of-the-line products and service. Free fit analysis to fine-tune running available on-site and more information available at offandrunning.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University graduate students are closer to unionizing. The students have gathered enough signatures to request formation under the Service Employees International Union. An eventual agreement with ISU would cover about 500 students who teach, run labs, grade papers, and conduct research. Trevor Rickard is a doctoral student in biology. Eric Zdansky is a graduate student in the sociology department. They're helping to organize the union at ISU. Zdansky called a successful strike and eventual agreement reached by University of Illinois grad students with the administration timely. And he said a strike by students at ISU is an open question.
Strikes have been historically a very powerful tool for unions. And, you know, in the past 20, 30 years, that power has been diminished through various laws that have been enacted. And in terms of whether or not a strike could happen, that's a matter of choice. If negotiations break down between administrators who make budgetary decisions, if they make that choice of whether or not they don't agree with modest improvements for graduate assistance.
A strike, though, Trevor, is something that you would pull out of that toolbox probably as a last resort, right? You don't start with a strike.
No, of course not. I mean, this is something that happens when negotiations break down. And at this point, that's not something that we've encountered.
You're not even really negotiating yet, are you?
You're still
in the process of organizing the union.
Right. We filed our union, yes, but we're in the process right now of democratically deciding what we'd like to see on our contracts. And so this is going to be something that we will organize by department. If every single department will say, hey, these are our issues, these are the things that we would like to see expanded, or some things that we'd like to see improved. And from there, we would talk about what kind of contracts we would like to write.
So I want to get to the department by department concept in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But first, I want to ask you about Illinois State University saying they're staying out of the organizing effort and that they are willing to negotiate once a union is formed, that they have plenty of experience of negotiating with all kinds of unions.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about them staying out of the organizing?
Well, I think that's fair, because in the end, we'd like to reduce bias. And we'd like to say, this is what the students and the workers of the departments said that they wanted, without the interference of, you know, whether or not my boss is going to be concerned of what I'm saying, right? And so in this way, we get more honest answers. And I believe that's probably the right way to go about it, is that we can go about organizing with the graduate workers, and then we can come together and have a conversation once we have that solidified.
So, Eric, what do you want? What are some of the basics you hope to get that graduate students don't have now?
Sure, that's a great question. So in terms of my personal story as being a graduate assistant, I've been on food stamps for about 3 out of the 4 semesters that I was a student, I'm still a student working on my master's thesis, done with coursework, though. And the fact that for a 20-hour appointment, I'm making $9,014. And so keeping in mind that the federal poverty line for one person in the contiguous United States and District of Columbia is $12,140, that's a problem. If you want to have trained master's students, and I'm talking about just master's students, and there's the, like we had said, different department by department pay grades for their master's students. If they're doing their own coursework, they're doing all of their TA responsibilities with faculty, grading, holding office hours, and on top of that, trying to produce a master's thesis, that living on $9,000 is difficult.
It is a part-time job, though. So where is the actual line here, and what, you know, the compensation you should receive? Should it be something as a part-time job, or is that a fair characterization?
I think to characterize the stipends and the work that we do as a part-time job is slightly misleading, because as a graduate student, there's not a very clear time when the workday starts and it ends. And so we have flexibility in when we're doing our grading or doing our assignments, and that's throughout the entire day into 3 o'clock in the morning. There's been several times where I've worked throughout the entire night in Trader Hall. And so the stipends need to act more in terms of like a full-time position that helps us not have to worry about financial burdens dealing with paying rent, paying for groceries. Those kind of financial stresses makes it that much more difficult to do the work that we need to do at Illinois State.
Well, let's back up for a moment. What are the things, for people who don't know, what are the things that graduate assistants do? Trevor?
It depends on what your task is. So, for instance, from semester to semester, I have different jobs that I will do. So some semesters I will be teaching multiple sections of microbiology. Some semesters I will be preparing laboratory materials for labs. So I'll pour out the plates, we'll make bacteria. I should say I'm working in a biology laboratory.
Okay.
So my tasks are a little bit different. So even as I work as a teacher, I also grade papers too. Even as I'm working as a prep TA some semesters, we're spending lots of time during the weekdays and the weekends to make sure that everything is organized correctly for our classrooms to be taught well.
How do you go department to department to sort of determine what a pay scale or a stipend, how would you form those baselines?
The first major difference between sociology and biology is that biology has a PhD program and sociology does not. So PhD students are always going to be paid more because their workloads are typically larger. They'll teach entire classes. They're in it for a longer haul, and so they typically get compensated financially better. And in terms of for the master's students in biology versus master's students in sociology, you know, we're assigned 20 hours with a faculty, and it varies from faculty member to faculty member, the kind of work that you end up doing. We still, for what I get to do, we go to all the classes, take notes, we'll hold office hours, make appointments with students, sometimes do all of the grading for a class, proctor exams. And so the graduate assistant is there to help the faculty member adequately teach the students. And so our working conditions as graduate assistants are really the learning conditions for undergraduate students.
All right. So how do you – would someone in biology get the same compensation package as somebody in sociology then, or would it be different? I mean, the PhD part of that aside.
I would probably argue that the workloads are going to be the same if you have a 20 hours. And so they're doing the same major three things, working on a thesis, doing their own coursework, and doing the various different tasks for their faculty members.
So there are more similarities than differences, is what I'm hearing, Trevor.
There's definitely similarities when it comes to teaching courses and grading papers. Since a lot of the positions in biology require lab work as opposed to just coursework, the needs can be a little bit different. But regardless, the amount of work I would suggest that is being performed to teach a course and grade a course as opposed to from biology to another department might be similar.
So you've recently reached a threshold in terms of the number of signatures you needed to get to move forward. How are the organizing efforts going?
We are currently in the process of doing a democratic evaluation of what we'd like to have written into our contracts. So as soon as we get a solid base of responses from each department, we can talk about what we'd like to do from there. So we haven't necessarily started negotiations with the university. We haven't brought that conversation forth yet, but we plan to, in the near future, approach that topic.
And with the Service Employees International Union, you've actually filed paperwork saying we want to be a local.
Yes. And so we're right now waiting on a response from the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board.
Why the SEIU? Why that particular overarching organization to organize under?
Well, in terms of when any union approached me about unionizing efforts, that was the first one. And so at the end of last summer, I had someone come into my office, which I thought was strange because it's the summertime and almost no one's on campus, and they had asked about unionizing. I was very much for it. And in, you know, the 2 years prior, I'd done coursework and my TAing responsibilities and, you know, formulating my thesis, there was not a single word of it. And so I thought that considering that they're wanting to advocate on our behalf and create a conversation about what is working at ISU and what isn't working for graduate assistants, that, you know, choosing that union that approached us was a good choice.
So once you get the responses back from the survey, then what?
Then we might go forth and start talking about how we want to have our contracts written. Now, in terms of the any bureaucratic process that might be happening underneath this all, I'm not entirely certain, but the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board, of course, has those laid out. So I might not know every single step involved in the bureaucratic side of it, but at least we can talk about concretely we will be negotiating.
How many different contracts? Is it going to be a different contract for each department?
I imagine that contracts are going to be written as departments need them, yes, because the amount of time to teach how many sections of courses might be different, or the amount. So you might say, okay, 10 hours for this, 10 hours for that. So you have 20 hours total, depending on how many things you're doing. If you're doing prep work, if you're doing teaching, if you're doing full teaching. So the needs of the department, I guess, will determine how the contracts are written.
Did the discussion of taxing compensation or tuition waivers, something that was being discussed earlier this year, which is income a graduate student really never really possesses in terms of a tuition waiver, did that affect this organizing process at all? Did it make it more urgent? Was it just one more thing you had to deal with?
I think it made people realize how important it is to maintain standards for higher education. Excuse me. When people recognized that, you know, higher education could be threatened by imposing a tax on tuition waivers and what that might mean for individuals who are working, people recognized, hey, you know, maybe we should actually take a stand and say, we do want some degree of standards. We actually do care about how things are handled here. And that did kind of create some attention on what we are doing currently.
What about union dues, and how would those be structured? Eric?
Union dues are typically a very small percentage of whatever kind of gains that the union through collective bargaining would be able to get.
And something you wanted to say, Trevor, about dues?
Yeah. In the case of SEIU, union dues would be at 2% of our paycheck. So if we were to raise stipends for our graduate workers, for instance, the union dues would be covered by the stipend raises, we would assume.
And what about the case before the U.S. Supreme Court on whether workers covered by a contract have to pay dues even if they're not members of the union?
Yeah, this is a little bit of an ideological battle, I believe. So I think you're referring to the Janus versus AFCME.
Yeah.
Depending on how the outcome of that case goes, you know, we might have to be creative in terms of how we function as a union. But I generally just don't agree with that because I don't believe that will create functioning unions if that was to actually pass, because either you're going to have an ideology of workers that say, yeah, we all believe that we should have a union that represents us, but should I pay into it? If people believe that they should pay into it, they will, and they will get the representation that they want based on how they support that union. That ultimately, if it does go in favor of Janus, I think we're going to have to rely on the faith of the workers, because if people don't want to pay into the union, they're not going to be able to get the representation that they desire. And that causes a fundamental problem for union membership and functionability. In effect, you wouldn't get out of it what you want.
Okay, Trevor, Eric, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you so
much. Thank you.
Trevor Rickard and Eric Zadansky are both Illinois State University graduate students and helping to organize a graduate student union. They both say they were approached on campus last summer by members of the Service Employees International Union to consider organizing at ISU. In an email statement, an Illinois State University spokesperson said the university has a long history of negotiating with unions representing personnel in different employment classifications, and that ISU is committed to a fair and equitable educational workplace for all students, faculty, and staff. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. During Sound Ideas, you'll hear about a new live music venue and restaurant in downtown Bloomington. John Norton talks with the owner of Night Shop ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For 20 years, Illinois State University Pride has found a way to help out local charities. And all it takes is a ton of sequins, false eyelashes, an on-point lip sync, and some talented queens and kings. Laura Kennedy has more.
It's a showcase of drag at the 20th Annual Illinois State University Pride Charity Drag Show, Friday the 23rd at 7 p.m. in the Brown Ballroom of ISU's Bone Student Center. The annual fundraising event features both student and professional drag kings and queens. And returning to the stage to MC again this year is Sharon Sharalike, who reveals this show has a special guest drag queen. Naomi Smalls, the season 8 runner-up on RuPaul's Drag Race. Sharon Sharalike says, don't be fooled by Naomi Smalls' diminutive name.
Because she's certainly not small. She's 7 foot tall when she's not wearing heels.
Wait a minute. She's 7 feet,
seven feet without heels. So she may reach 8 feet. We'll see. I'm like 2 feet tall with heels.
So people who did not see season 8 of RuPaul's Drag Race, to see her make it to the top 3, how would you describe Naomi Smalls?
She's very stylish, very slender, beautiful to look at, and she just has a real flair for costuming, and she was kind of raised looking at fashion all the time, and that when you can definitely tell when you see her perform, you know, that's the style that she has.
So she has a sort of model mystique
going on in her
drag.
Uh-huh. Very beautiful.
Well, do you find that after 20 years that the ISU Charity Drag Show is maybe a destination for some drag queens, that playing at that might be something prideful for them because it is for charity. This is something very special.
Well, it's the show that people want to be a part of. It's very prestigious, and we've had a lot of different performers over the years. A few of them have kind of been there all through the years. I've worked with Seduction for many, many years, and she'll be there again this year. But I have seen a lot of different performers kind of come and go. So a lot of times what happens, we'll have student performers that perform there, and then they go on to become more professional performers. And so then they're invited back to perform at the ISC Pride Show. And that's kind of the case this year. We have some returning student performers that are coming back as professionals. So it definitely kind of raises drag queens and kings.
So how important is it to you to have students performing as part of this drag show?
That's been a big part of the show all the time. The students, they want to be a part of the show. It gives them an opportunity to perform in front of a large crowd, which a lot of times a younger performer doesn't get that opportunity. And they audition, and so they go through that process too. So I think it's really important that we have them as part of it. And they actually run the show, too. You know, they run all the sound and lighting and organizing the show. So they're a huge part of it.
Well, let's talk about the outfits that you'll be having. Now, you always have something pretty dang spectacular over and over again. I remember one year you had an outfit with wings that came out that you just pulled a lever and boom, these wings came out.
That was a hard one.
It was amazing.
You can see that on my YouTube tutorial, how to make wings.
Because we all need to know how to make wings.
You need to know how to make your own wings.
You wouldn't believe how that comes in handy. So do you have any plans, Sharon, this year for some interesting outfits?
I'm just starting on them now, to tell you the truth.
Okay, so you're going to keep that secret.
Yes. Well, I always like a big headdress, so I'm going to do something that involves a lot of feathers. So that'll be my opening number. And then I'm not sure yet what I want to do for my second number, but I'll figure it out.
For 20 years, this drag show has been going on, and you've been doing drag for a couple of years yourself.
Yeah, I've been going for 20 years, too.
What changes have you seen in drag in those 20 years?
There's a lot more diversity in performing. You know, you see a lot of different type performers, whereas before, most drag queens had a certain look, you know.
Sort of glam and,
yeah,
and showgirlish.
Overdone, you know, and now there's bearded queens and queens that have more grunge look. You know, there's just many different styles that I didn't always see when I started. You know, there was one specific thing we were all kind of going for.
So
and now there's many things.
Are you happy about the changes that it's really broadening out?
You know, I'm fine with it. I think it needs to be an expression, you know, of whatever somebody thinks is drag. That's kind of what they need to put out there. But I definitely would like to see good drag, quality drag. You know, whatever vein you're going to go in, you better be great at it.
We talk a lot these days about gender.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about trans individuals and so forth.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if the fact that we are more open with talking about gender is maybe opening things up in drag a little bit more, too, or making drag change a bit.
It seems like just lately, we've been having this conversation because RuPaul made some comments about, like, transgender people not being as accepted in her show, Drag Race. And I wasn't as surprised about it as a lot of people were, because I've been in the pageant industry almost my entire drag career. And there's different types of pageants, and so they have different rules about that in the different pageants. So it didn't really shock me if she wants to have it where it's, you know, only males can compete. Because there's some pageants that it only allows for males to compete. Some pageants let you have body work and face work done, mm-hmm. but you still have to have, like, male genitalia. But on the other hand, too, I can see where it makes people feel like they're not a part of or accepted in. So I'm not really sure if it's going to mean we have more shows that allow all different types of contestants, or if it means that, like, Drag Race needs to open up more and become more accepting of everyone. I guess we'll just kind of see how that plays out.
Let's talk about the audiences at drag shows. Now, if someone's never been to a drag show before, do they need to, you know, understand, is there a certain way of behaving at a drag show when you're a member of the audience?
Well, come to have fun. Be ready to, like, make fun of yourself and everyone else. You know, I like to play with people and just have a good time, and I don't care if you make fun of me, too. I'm all for it. Drag queens love to get tipped, so bring your dollar bills, you know, and go up and tip the queen. Some people are, like, afraid to go up there. They think, well, maybe I'm interrupting the performance or something, but that's not the case at all. You know, we love that interaction. It used to be, when the shows first started years ago, it was almost all a gay crowd, and now it's predominantly a straight crowd. There's still tons of gay people there, but there's a ton of straight people. It's just become much more acceptable, and people know now that it's just a big, fun show, and they're coming just to have fun with us, and I really appreciate it. I think it's fantastic. It's just a lot of fun, and anybody's invited, and we love to have everybody there.
What is it like, Sharon, when you're all made up, you've got this great costume on, you've got the makeup, you've got the hair, you've got the feathers, all this stuff going on? Does this make you feel a little more free to say what you want? Is it freeing as an individual when you're in drag?
Yes, especially when I make a costume and it's a really cool costume and I'm really proud of it, and that moment where you get to, like, introduce it to everyone, it's kind of like
powerful.
It's being an artist, you know, and kind of like doing a gallery show.
Yes.
You know, because you're going out and you're showing this work of art that you made. So it's, and you get to be in the piece of art. You're not on the sideline. You're actually a participant in this piece of art, and people are viewing you. And that's pretty empowering, I have to admit. As far as just being in drag, I feel like I'm a lot more outgoing. I'm a pretty outgoing person just in general, but when I'm in drag, I feel like my character allows me to be a little more, you know, flirtatious or funny, or be able to make fun of people, you know, without them getting mad at me. You know, you wouldn't just walk up to somebody in the Kroger and start making fun of them, and then they laugh and say, you're hilarious. But in drag, somehow, it's like, you are hilarious.
So can you tell me about some of the artists that you've booked in who will be performing?
Yeah, we have Anti-Heroin. She's been there for a couple years now, and she was one of the students that performed, and she's coming back as a professional. XO is also one of the students that's coming back as a professional. We have Holden Ryder Gently, who's been there before, and I mentioned earlier that we have Seduction coming in, and then a performer called Clairvoyant. She's from Chicago, so we're excited to have her. And then we have, of course, the student performers as well. And we're doing a after show at the Bistro after that. They're celebrating their 25 years
wow.
in service, so that's pretty amazing, too. And so we'll have all these performers come to the bar afterwards and do a show there.
How long does it take you, Sharon, to get made up?
I plan about 3 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah, to get ready. There's a lot involved. It's not just putting on makeup, because I have to cover my own eyebrows. It's the whole system that you go through to make it look like you don't have any eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
And then you draw on new eyebrows. Like my
I should fire. Try that, because it's either that or save up for a brow lift.
And then I've started this idea of taping, where you, like, tape your face so it, like, pulls it back tighter. Seems it's kind of fun.
You know, Marlena Dietrich used to do that.
Yeah. So I've been working on that. I haven't actually done it yet, but I've been practicing, because I don't want to try it at a show, and all of a sudden my tape pops and my face just falls down. It's like, what happened to her? Did she just have a stroke? So I'm a little nervous about that. But yeah, I want to do it. I did it the other day at home just practicing, and it was very effective. It was kind of exciting. So I think I want to try it, but we'll see what happens. I'm sure I'll be talking about it at the show. I tell everybody my secrets on stage. So
that's the beauty of it. Know, it's interesting because on the one hand, you've got all these layers of clothing and makeup and everything, but you're also, in a way, sort of exposed because we all are sort of in on it.
Yeah. Well, I always laugh, too, because I try to look naked a lot of times in my costumes, but the truth is I'm, like, wearing more clothes than ever. You know, I've got layer upon layer upon layer just to try to look naked. So it's definitely an illusion.
So tell me about the charity that will be benefiting from the Charity Drag Show.
This year the proceeds are all going to the Central Illinois Friends. And it's an organization that provides services to individuals living with HIV and offers them preventative services. And they're also going to be doing a free, discreet HIV screening at the Student Services Building right across the street during the ISU Pride Show.
That's Sharon Sharalike, host of the 20th Annual Illinois State University Pride Charity Drag Show, Friday, the 23rd at 7 p.m. in the Brown Ballroom of ISU's Bone Student Center. I'm Laura Kennedy.
See a slideshow of the creative costumes handmade by Sharon Sharalike at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Longtime local musician and promoter Chris Gulwitzer realized a dream this month when he opened Night Shop on the north end of downtown Bloomington. The live music venue and restaurant is designed to accommodate up to 150 music fans. GLT's John Norton visited Gulwitzer recently to take a look. He says his vision was to connect the dots between the larger rooms in Bloomington Normal and the independent underground DIY scene.
Basements, shows in kitchens, shows in alternative spaces, and I wanted to connect the dots up to the Castle Theater, the BCPA, Six Strings, etc. There was nothing in between for not just local acts, but for touring acts as well.
So when you're booking acts here at the Night Shop, are you essentially booking acts that were playing house shows in town?
Some of them, absolutely. Some of them that played house shows and small shows in other markets. But we've also booked some larger acts as well. Not necessarily acts that would fill a place like the Castle, but certainly artists that will draw 100, 150, 200, etc.
What kind of acts are you looking for genre-wise?
It's a very broad spectrum.
Okay.
We have only been open as a restaurant bar, per se, with regular hours for 1 week. But before that, we already had 8 shows. There was a Grateful Dead tribute band. There was a punk show. There was an alt-country folk show. There was a hip-hop and electronic show. There was a metal show. We are covering the entire board, as far as I'm concerned, where we come into some exclusivity is that we're trying to primarily cater to original music.
Opening a live music club is difficult anywhere, New York City or Bloomington Normal.
It's true.
Okay. Why did you think this would work?
I thought this would work because it's not just Bloomington Normal that we're catering to. It's the surrounding areas like Peoria, Champaign, and Springfield. It's even Chicago and St. Louis. You could go see an act in Chicago, play in a big room, but if they played a couple hours south, elsewhere on the same tour, and you could see them in a room of 150 or 200 people instead, a room where they're also hanging out in the room with you and you meet the artist, that's a pretty good experience that people will absolutely want to take part in. Also, because of our proximity to other places, entertainment travels through the area all the time. So we're trying to get people to stop when they're going from one place to the other. And in addition to that, you have the colleges in town, universities, you have a lot of young professionals, you have a lot of middle-aged people, you even have the older generations who all enjoy music. We're trying to be a place for everyone. Because we're a restaurant, we have the capability of being all ages until 10 p.m. We're doing a lot of our music earlier in the night. So high school kids could come here if they wanted to.
Well, let's talk about that. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton, talking with Chris Goldwitzer, the owner of The Night Shop, just opened in downtown Bloomington. Let's talk about the music side, and then I want to get to that restaurant side. Mm-hmm. When we talked a few months ago, you wanted The Night Shop specifically to be an artist-friendly venue. Can you talk about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and how maybe that's different than a lot of different places?
I come from this from the background of being a musician myself. I've toured before. I've played hundreds of shows all around the country. I know how it feels to be treated well when you play somewhere. And you don't have to go way overboard to treat someone well. You respect what they want. You cater to their needs.
For example, what are you doing?
Well, if a band is playing here on tour and they need to do laundry, they can do laundry here.
Because you've got a washer-dryer up here.
Yes, we do.
We're upstairs right now, by the way. You said this used to be an apartment.
It did.
And this is going to be a green room now?
Yeah, it's going to be a very nice green room.
Okay. So you've got a washer-dryer.
Yeah, washer-dryer.
How else are you catering to the artist then?
Well, there's a shower up here that someone could use if they needed to on the road. But we put in a really nice sound system. It feels great to sound great. And we put in a nice stage. It feels good to stand over a crowd and to look good. We put in really good lights. For a room of this size, I feel like we definitely went over the top in putting in a good sound system and lighting. It's really going to make the shows, whether you're a small band who's only played in your basement or a band who's been experienced and logged time on stages all over the place, you're going to have the same sort of experience.
And I would imagine word gets around then, regionally and nationally even?
Absolutely.
And then that helps you book more bands, too.
Oh, definitely. If you take care of a group on tour, their agent hears about it, they're going to try to run the rest of their roster through the area. Bands have friends that are in other bands. And truly, in many ways, it's who you know. For instance, a friend of the scene here is Rose from the band The Poster Children.
Oh, yes, Rose Marshak.
And Rose brought a show my way, and we booked it here. Monday, May 7th, Mesthetics are playing here, which is the new band featuring the rhythm section of Fugazi.
No kidding.
And this place is named after a Fugazi song, so that was kind of a trip for me.
So you're like Waiting Room Records, which is also named after
exactly
a Fugazi song. Very cool.
Yeah.
This is Chris Goldwitzer on GLT Sound Ideas. I am John Norton, and we're talking about his club, The Night Shop, in downtown Bloomington. And I asked you about how you think you can fit into the music scene, but how does a night shop work with, not necessarily work with other venues, but how does it fit into the scene to make it a better scene, a better music scene? Can it work with other people, or does it, because of the buzz here, other places can feed off of you, or you can feed off the castle? How does that all fit in that way?
Well, it's still taking shape, but I think absolutely we are building a momentum, especially in downtown Bloomington, that I'm not saying hasn't been here before, but maybe it's been a little while, certainly for this end of downtown.
Yeah.
And if we're booking a lot of dates, which we are, people will see that, and they'll think that Bloomington is a place that they need to go.
Do you have any idea how the other venues feel, and how do you feel about everybody kind of working together and helping each other out? Do you feel it's a collaborative thing, even if you're not specifically working together?
I feel that it should be a collaborative thing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not feeling any sort of competition. The owners of many of the surrounding businesses and venues have stopped in here to check it out, whether to stop in when we've had a live show or just to come in and partake in our food, etc. And they've had good things to say. They've had advice for me. I listen. I feel like we can absolutely work together, and I'm excited to grow that through this process.
You need more than just music and drinks to make it as a club, I would imagine.
You are absolutely correct. Part of having a music venue is that you've got to have libations for the people attending.
Right. That's a given.
And to get a liquor license in downtown Bloomington, you need to serve food. So we have a restaurant license here, and we have a good-sized kitchen, and we've really gone all in with the food. It allows us to wear many hats and to appeal to many different crowds.
How does the lunch crowd fit into what you're doing business-wise?
It's crucial because we have a bit of a tricky setup here logistically in that we are one room at this point. We are a room that is a restaurant. We are a room that is a music venue. And many shows are standing room only. You can't have a bunch of tables and chairs in the way. You got to move the tables and chairs out of the way. If there's no tables and chairs, you're not going to sell very much food. With that in mind, if we have a lot of shows at night, we've really got to sell a lot of food when that's not happening, and that's the rest of the day.
Okay, all right. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Chris Goldwitzer. We're upstairs from the Night Shop in downtown Bloomington. This is a beautiful club. This is no dive bar. This is no hole in the wall.
No, it's not. It turned out better than we could have possibly imagined. And it was a significant investment of time, energy, and money to make this happen. I don't want them to get hung up on that because it's also a place where you can hear punk music.
Right.
You can come in here looking like a dirtbag.
Right.
It's a rock and roll club that serves high-end bar food.
Well, you've got some good bands lined up already this week, and you've got a regular lineup coming. What else, Chris, do you see down the road that you want that still needs to be done here?
Well, we're going to have a really nice outdoor area that will be ready in a couple of months.
With live music outdoors?
We're trying to do that. There's going to be a stage out there. We still have to navigate the waters with the noise ordinance for the city of Bloomington.
Yeah.
But it could be really nice. It's going to be really nice to sit out there and eat outside, have a drink outside.
Will it be covered?
It's partially covered, a little over halfway, but there'll still be plenty of open air, open sunlight.
Well, Chris Goldwitzer, great to catch up with you. Great to see the Night Shop in downtown Bloomington. A few people have been here for shows. It's the first time I've been in since you opened it. This is, again, like I said, it's absolutely beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I hope you come back.
GLT's John Norton talking with Night Shop owner Chris Goldwitzer. The new music venue on the north end of downtown Bloomington has live music this Wednesday through Saturday nights. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find all the news and interviews you heard today on the show. Let us know what you think at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.